Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silken at Nenburn. I'm joined via Skype by Frank Cogliano, who is in Charlottesville, Virginia. How are things in Virginia, Frank?
Things are great in Virginia, David. Well, I know that our listeners really love my weather reports. It's sunny and mild for mid-January. It's actually in the low 60s right now, so it's really nice. We can't enjoy good weather because it's all climate change, and so we know it's terrible. But.
Yes. All right.
Anyway, Happy New Year, David.
Yes, Happy New Year. This is our first episode of 2020, and so we thought we would take this episode to look back on the past 20 years and to sort of assess what historians in the future may say about what's happened in the past two decades, the first two decades of this new century and millennium.
So, David, are you of the view that this is a new decade?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's the argument that the decade starts in 2021. I guess there's an argument for that, but then you miss all the good parties. I don't know. It doesn't really make a difference.
I agree.
So the premise we're going to use for this episode is try to think about, okay, what's going to be in textbooks for students about these past two decades. Usually about 20 years is about what high school textbook chapter covers. And so we try to figure out, okay, what's important of the past two decades that's going to make it into these books and make it into undergraduate lectures in the American History Survey course. And we've each come up with sort of lists of things we think are important. But before we get to that, I guess we have to tackle the question, is it too soon to talk about the last 20 years?
No, I think there's a more urgent question we have to consider, which is just how sweet it is that you have faith that there'll still be textbooks in the future. But,
Well, the textbook industry is a huge thing, so I don't know.
That's true.
Whatever the next millennia version of textbooks is. Is it too soon for us as historians to assess these things, Frank, or not?
Certainly whether it's too soon for historians to assess them is too soon for us as historians, because both you and I deal with longer periods of time. Of course, our medieval and ancient history colleagues would laugh at us when we say we deal with large periods of time, but we're not so good in dealing with the immediate past, and I think it's very difficult to know what is significant. You know, if you want to project ahead 100 years and whatever the successor to a textbook is in 2120 and how they'll look at this period, you know, it might only be a paragraph in that mythical textbook, and what they emphasize might be different from what we would emphasize. But we do have some insight, I hope, as students of the past and as people who teach young people about the past. So what's interesting to me, I guess, and I'm wittering on, I apologize, is how long ago 2020 now seems.
Yes, it does.
On one hand, it seems like yesterday, and I can remember all kinds of things about 2020 and 2021 and the first decades of this country. On the other, I mean, most of our new students now would all have been born in what, 2002?
Yep, or 2001, 2002.
Our new undergrads.
Yeah. So what were you doing? Where were you 20 years ago? Just so we can sort of
teaching at the University
of Edinburgh. Okay.
I arrived at Edinburgh in 1997, so I was a much younger person teaching at the University of Edinburgh. You know, we have all those new young colleagues who are smart and enthusiastic. I was one of those.
It's been downhill since then, right? Okay.
Yeah, so I was at Edinburgh, and I had very young children at that point, and so I was my life wasn't remarkably different than it is now, and I say that with kind of happiness and reflection. Where were you 20 years ago?
20 years ago, I had recently graduated from undergrad. I was teaching high school in Florida, and at that point, I had two children.
So you were in Florida for the 2000 election?
Are we going to get into this? Yes, I was in Florida for that election, yes.
Okay, we might return to that election, I suspect.
Yes, we will return to that election. That was a long night.
Yes.
Yes. I told myself I would go to sleep as soon as they determined the winner, and that didn't happen.
Well, actually, reflecting, I recently was, I can't remember, I was changing computers, or I was looking through some old photographs on my computer, and I came across a great one. Well, it's not a great one, except it's so telling. You may remember this from the 2016 election party that we hosted.
Yes.
And there was a professional photographer at that event, as you probably remember, who took some wonderful pictures. And I downloaded the ones that were of interest to me. And there's a great photo of you and your wife, Ida, at about 4 a.m. when things were coming in. When reality or the results were pretty clear at that point. And it's, you've probably seen the photo, but you're wearing this kind of hat, boater,
yes,
that they gave out, and you have a red, white, and blue lei on.
Yes, yes, I remember that. That was when the night still had, there was still a chance that things would turn out different.
But you had a pretty far away look in your eyes at that point, because you still had your lei on and your hat, but the results were in. And anyway, it's a great photo from that night, and that was 4 years ago now, although
yes,
it seems like a lifetime.
So I mean, the task of looking back, you know, immediately when something's ended, it reminds me of a really interesting book. I don't know whether you've read this book, Frank. It's called Only Yesterday, that was published in 1931, by Frederick Lewis Allen, who was a journalist and a historian, sort of an amateur historian. He wrote for Harper's and a variety of other things. But he writes this in 1931 about sort of the decade that just happened, and so it's about sort of the, you know, when we're living day by day, we tend not to see how profound changes are. But he looks back from 1931 to the decade that had just passed, and you know, is profoundly, you know, it's about how the world in some ways was a radically different place than it had been a decade earlier. And I think, you know, in talking prior to the show, I think one of the things we realized is really how much the world has changed. Even if you were still in Edinburgh 20 years ago, the world is a very different place than it was 20 years ago. And the U.S. is a very different place. You know, I think lots of historians are apprehensive about talking about recent history because they think, like, we don't have enough time and distance from it to be objective. I think that's the objection some historians have to talking about the recent past. But I think especially when it comes to teaching, whether it's teaching high school students or undergraduates or what have you, talking about the recent past is actually really important because they don't remember, they don't know the recent past. You know, I remember when I was in high school, I think we got up to the 1970s. In history classes, and they assume so we knew what happened after that, but of course we didn't know what happened after that, even if we were alive during that period, because, you know, I was a pretty cognizant 5-year-old about politics, but probably not as cognizant as I should have been or could have been.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a kind of classic joke, isn't there, that when you teach the survey course, although the second half of the survey is meant to get up to the present, we never get as far as the present. You're right, we usually stop about 30 years before the present, and so you're right, and assume the kids will work it out. I mean, again, to think about our incoming group of undergraduates who are, you know, were born in 2001 or 2002, they don't remember 9/11.
No, they don't.
I mean, they don't remember a pre-digital world, and a pre-digital and analog world, but they, you know, 9/11 it might mean something to them because they will have learned about it, but, you know, 9/11 might as well be the Peloponnesian War as far as they're concerned.
To be sure, right? And, you know, I actually, when we had a year-long survey course at Edinburgh, I was running the course administrator, I asked some of our 20th century colleagues to actually bring the course up through to at least 2008 because so many of the students wouldn't have, I guess we were sort of stopping with the end of the Cold War or something. And I said, well, that's great, but, you know, there's still a huge gap that we need to sort of think about. And so I asked them to sort of add that, and so we can get the recent present. So I think it's important we do it, even if it's hard.
Yeah, so I agree. I mean, if you think about the alleged end of the Cold War in 1989 or 91 or whenever you want to date it, that's now 30 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah, we don't want to think it's 30 years ago, but it was 30 years ago, right? All right, so let's think about the past 20 years, Frank. What would, if we're a textbook, we've got limited space, we only can have, you know, room to address a handful of big events and themes. What are the highlights that you would want on there?
Okay, so this is a U.S. history textbook, so we're assuming the United States still exists.
Exactly, okay, in the future.
Well, yes, we're U.S. Okay. historians, and that's the focus of this podcast. So it's a U.S. history textbook at some time in the future, looking at the turn of the from the 20th to the 21st century and the first decades of the 21st century, right?
Yes.
That's our premise.
That's
our premise. That's good. It seems to me that there are two really major things that help explain much of what's happened over the past 20 years. The first is technology. Let's consider for a second how we're recording this podcast. Well, let's consider for a second we have a podcast.
Cast, right. Yes.
So there's the technological revolution that we're in the midst of, and I think that's probably number one. And a lot of the changes that have arisen from that. And the second one is in terms of geopolitics, but in terms of its impact on both the United States domestically, but also its place in the world, has to be 9/11 and its consequences, both intended and unintended. So those would be the two things that I think really are crucially important if we're thinking about this mythical textbook. There are lots of other things, of course, but I think those are the two things that would be kind of front and center, because most of what we're talking about in terms of social change, politics, and so on, arise from those two factors. What about you?
Well, let's see if we can sort of, because I think we need to sort of take some of these things.
Yeah, we can unpack.
I think let's unpack first sort of the war on terror, because I think that's starting with 9/11, what would be the big events in the war on terror, the themes of the war on terror that you would think that we'd want to cover in this hypothetical textbook?
Well, to a certain extent, you know, historians love to think about centuries, you know, the long 19th century, the short 20th century, all that sort of thing. I think that 9/11 marks a quite clear end, if you will, to the 20th century, notwithstanding the debate about when a century begins or ends or a decade. I think because it's a clear turning point, not just for the United States, but because of the response to it by the United States and its allies, it represents a real sea change. And I think you can see the 21st century is beginning then, at least from a U.S. standpoint. So in terms of the big things, you know, there we get the war on terror as a result of that. And with all that involved and has continued to involve. So it's big for 9/11 initiated what is now continues to be the longest war in American history, longer than Vietnam, longer than the War of Independence, you know, in Afghanistan, which is ongoing as we record this now, almost 20 years later. So we have that. We have the debate about presidential power and war powers, which we've seen play out most recently in the past couple of weeks over Donald Trump and Iran, but that's an ongoing thing. Now, that all of these things precede 9/11, of course, but I think 9/11 brings them into focus.
Yeah.
The
9/11 is one of those few events where I think we knew it was historic as it was happening, right? So it wasn't one of these events
that's
that
right.
we needed.
That's right.
You know, like the Kennedy assassination,
right.
Everyone knows where they were.
Yeah, I mean, so it's, yeah, where were you on 9/11?
I was teaching high school. I remember it was early in the morning. I was in Florida, so it was early, relatively early in the class day. I had gotten in the habit the previous year during the 2000 election of checking CNN, the website between classes, because of all the recount stuff in Florida, and that was sort of the easiest way to sort of see the recount stuff, and that just become a habit of mine. And then I saw that there was, you know, the planes crashed, the first plane crashing in New York, and so we had a small television in the classroom, and I turned it on. We spent a decent part of the morning sort of watching it live. And for reasons that wasn't entirely clear, the sound wasn't working on the television. And so we were sort of watching it with closed captioning, and students were asking me to provide context for what was going on, which was a intellectual challenge. But where were you?
I was cutting my grass in our old flat in Edinburgh because I was meant to leave the next day on the 12th of September to go to the U.S. on a research trip. And so I was cutting my grass and a friend of mine called me and said, called our landline.
Landlines, right.
But they weren't as important as they are now or ubiquitous. Called our landline and said, turn on the TV. And I did not finish cutting the grass that day, and indeed my flight was did not go ahead the next day, and my trip was canceled. But I have a really distinct memory of that day. But it's interesting, again, you said you were looking at the CNN website. You know, websites would have been new and kind of cutting-edge stuff then.
Yes, they were.
Relatively speaking. So as a way to get your news. So that's interesting. But so we get the war on terror arising from that. We get the questions about civil liberties, the use of torture, what American values are that have arisen from that. We get the opposition to the war. We got the invasion of Iraq and all that's followed from that, which we're still living with. I think all of that can be traced back to 9/11. I think we get Barack Obama as president as a consequence of 9/11, the kind of social change that might not have happened otherwise, because of his, you know, he really made his name via his opposition to the war, the invasion of Iraq, not the Afghanistan war. So I think a lot of the world we live in was created by the events on 9/11. It's very rare that we get a singular day like that or a singular event that has such an impact. And of course, nothing is monocausal. I understand that. I mean, to some extent, 9/11 was the result of a lot of trends that were a long time in the making. A lot of the other things we're talking about, like the rise of the kind of military-industrial state in the United States, have deep roots, you know, not just related to 9/11. But I think 9/11 was a really important turning point. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I 100% agree with that. I think that's the one part of this that, you know, I think is inevitably going to be, you know, the central theme of whatever this future textbook chapter looks like.
Can I put a counterfactual to you?
Yes.
About why 9/11 is so important, and students like counterfactuals. If Al Gore is the president on 9/11, what does the world look like today? So we're going back to the 2000 election and the Florida recount and all that. But let's suppose for the sake, you know, that was not a clear outcome. So let's suppose, it came down to the Supreme Court picking the president. Let's suppose for a second that Al Gore was the president of the United States on 9/11. What do you think the world looks like?
That's a really good question. I'm going to give an oblique answer. Not long after 9/11, there was an article in the Journal of American History that posed the counterfactual, what would have happened had Henry Clay won the election of 1844 instead of James K. Polk. And it makes this argument about if Clay had gotten elected, then the Civil War wouldn't have happened the same way that it did. And it sort of plays out this counterfactual going forward, you know, two decades. And the problem that I think people had with that article was the world is such a complicated place and politics and society are so complicated that running counterfactuals more than two or three steps down the road is really, really hard. So, I mean, if Al Gore had been elected, would we have gone to war in Afghanistan? Yeah, I think we would have. I think.
I think you're right. I think the pressure to respond militarily would have been overwhelming. I think. Okay. Go to war
in
Afghanistan.
So in that case, the tone would have been different. The rhetoric would have been different.
Maybe we go to war. I think we take military action in Afghanistan. Whether we go to war in Afghanistan, you know, one of the key turning points about 9/11 is the response is to launch this war on terror and use this this rhetoric of war as opposed to treating it like a crime. So maybe they attack Afghanistan or attack the Taliban or try to kill bin Laden, but maybe the United States doesn't commit to a war in Afghanistan that's lasted two decades.
Maybe. But that gives the president the power to sort of make those kinds of choices that I'm not sure that, at least in that case, you know, the overwhelming force of things may have pushed Gore to do this more or less the same things that Bush did. Maybe you would have had a different tone, or that if they wouldn't have had the sort of axis of evil language, maybe, but hard to say. Beyond that, would we have a war in Iraq? Probably not.
No, I think not, and I think that means that more resources could have been devoted to the war in Afghanistan that might have been handled differently.
Does Al Gore get reelected in 2004? Beats the hell out of me. All right, I have a hard enough time figuring out what does happen,
right?
What did happen? That sort of playing out these kind of factuals is kind of, I guess it's fun. I enjoy doing it, but I'm the world would be different, but exactly how it would be different is a tricky thing.
Well, I think the U.S. I agree with you. I mean, but I think the U.S. goes to war in Afghanistan or takes military action in Afghanistan. I think it does so with greater heed to its allies.
Okay.
Which would be important, although George W. Bush did appreciate the importance of trying to build coalitions. He just couldn't do it very well. I don't think the United States goes to war with Iraq.
Yeah.
And I think the destabilization of the wider Middle East that's happened since the invasion of Iraq in 2003 is pretty profound. And I think and I don't know what the Middle East looks like. You're right. That's where you get a step removed. But I don't think that happens. The other crucial thing, which I think is really important, is I think the United States does more earlier about climate change.
Yes.
Because of, you know, that was definitely a preoccupation of Gore at that time. And
although it only became a preoccupation of Gore's after that election, when he grew the beard, if you look at the actual campaign, you know, their policy differences weren't as profound as they would become after the election.
Right, but I guess. I mean, you're right. Once you get one step removed, I guess 9/11 is interesting and the counterfactual works in a way that maybe the Henry Clay one doesn't, is because, okay, that was a crisis that required a presidential response, and therefore an individual, you know, who that individual was making the response really does make a difference, and a lot followed on from that.
Hmm. Well, the counterfactual with Henry Clay is like Clay wouldn't have gone to war with Mexico, and if we don't go to war with Mexico, they could sell all the things, right? The world would be a very different place had a couple of hanging chads been adjudicated differently. Right. So this, the second thing the mention of the big theme, I guess, that you sort of highlighted was the role of technology. And I think that's a really profound, I mean, we do live in a profoundly different world now because of that in terms of everything, right? The fact that we're doing this podcast on Skype, neither Skype nor podcasts existed 20 years ago.
No, and I apologize for the quality of the sound quality here, which I know won't be brilliant, but I'm sitting here in Charlottesville. You're sitting in Edinburgh. I'm speaking to you on my mobile phone via Skype with wireless headphones on. You know that.
None of these words mean anything in 2000, right?
Yes,
like
our that's
entire
right.
language has you changed.
Know, yes, Bluetooth wasn't a thing. Mm-hmm. you know, so we do now. The internet existed then. It was just, but we were at the beginning, and one could argue we're still at the beginning of it, but we were at the beginning of a technological revolution that's still playing itself out.
So, I mean, there's obviously all the ways in which that we know this has happened. It changes the way that we shop. It changes the way that we interact. Social media changes the way that people who date. It changes all kinds of, what are the broader social consequences of this technological revolution?
Oh, this is definitely one we don't know. We are the wrong people to ask because we're both, at least in my case, too old, but it's also we're at the beginning of this. I think the biggest one that we're just coming to grips with is social media. I think that social media has – because there are lots of other things we might discuss as themes that, you know, when we're in preparation for this broadcast, we were talking about various things, and you'd mentioned things like political polarization, inequality, etc. To a certain extent, those are all amplified by as a result of social media.
Yeah.
And we are just at the beginning of trying to understand how social media affects our brains and our behavior, and people who think they're smart and not susceptible to it are susceptible to it, and that includes you and me.
Oh, to be sure.
And the influence of it and what we see. And I think the internet has transformed our lives in all kinds of ways. But I think social media is a huge one that we, and I don't think the people who created it appreciate it or understand it entirely yet. I think that's one. I think the impact of technology, but particularly the internet, on the way we shop and commerce is really important. So if you look at any, why are small towns, main streets in America or high streets in Britain dying? Because nobody goes out to shop anymore. So, you know, if you look at any high street in a British town, it's all coffee shops and places to get your hair done because nobody buys anything but coffee and haircuts anymore.
Exactly, yeah.
Because everything else you buy online. And I think that's transformed the infrastructure of our cities and towns. I think it's transforming how we interact with each other. I think that's had a profound impact. And again, it hasn't finished playing itself out yet. There's no doubt about that. What do you think?
Well, I think you're right about the sort of the commerce aspect of it. You look at sort of the biggest corporations in 2000. It's things like GM and ExxonMobil and Walmart. And now, you know, if you look at the biggest corporations, they're not things that corporations necessarily make physical things, but they make tremendous amounts of profit off of virtual things. So Microsoft, Amazon, Google, these are all enormously profitable corporations, but that we're in a very different kind of world. I think the kind of fragmentation that the internet has created about the ways in which we participate in mass culture is really profound. I think the ways in which the internet allows for narrow casting of things has both created opportunities for lots of people to do new things, which it creates opportunities for people to create podcasts because they want to and communicate to people around the world if people want to listen. But on the other hand, it allows for people to very narrowly be targeted and to target other people, which is means we're sort of in a very different landscape that we're still, I think you're right, still trying to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, David, I assume you saw the latest Star Wars film, The Rise of Skywalker.
I of course I did.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. In fact, we should do a podcast on that. And it's the alleged end of the saga, et cetera, et cetera. One thing that struck me, and, you know, I watched the movie. I thought it was okay. I thought it was pretty good, actually. You know, in following the response to it online, but particularly on social media, and the way the movie's been dissected, does it betray George Lucas or betray this or that or incontinuity? You know, it used to be, I mean, at the beginning of this century, we were at the beginning of the prequel trilogy in Star Wars, which was pretty poor, but that's a different discussion. but you just went to see it and you talked about it with your friends. At that point, you didn't interact with the whole world on it and break it down frame by frame. So now, you know, so to take that as an example.
You were not clearly on internet Star Wars forums in the early 2000s because people were doing that then too. But okay.
They were, David. But you see, I had a job and I had that. there were listservs then, though, weren't there?
They were slightly anyway. That's slightly more advanced.
They were chat rooms in
2003. Yes.
It wasn't what it is today, is what I'm saying.
To be sure. Yes.
You know, people ranting about this, that, and the other thing, and the social media response to all this kind of pop culture thing. But you're right. It's also allowed the creation of communities of people who are interested in everything. If you want to go on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook or Reddit, you're going to find a group of people who are interested in what you're interested in. And that's liberating on one hand. There's been a kind of democratization of knowledge and sociability, and that's positive, but it also comes with all kinds of downsides too. Because you were talking about the biggest corporations in the world, and there's a tendency, especially among right-wing populists who traffic in nostalgia about the good old days, whatever the good old days were, to say, well, we used to make things, we don't do that anymore. Well, no, we've got corporations now that have monetized our attention. It's the kind of power, you know, Henry Ford couldn't have dreamed of, and that's an extraordinary thing, but we're still working out what that means, again, for both good and bad, I think.
All right. Yeah, okay, so that will be a section, although future historians will have to have some do some unpacking to figure out what all this means.
Yes.
Okay, so the other things I had on my list, and I had three other things I think are probably gonna might fit in this chapter. One is political polarization. I think one of the things that's happened over the past 20 years is that we've become the United States has become a much more politically polarized country. And I think the relationship between that and the internet is not incidental. I think those are significantly related to one another. You know, if you look at the 2000 election, as much as we can sort of see Bush and Gore as being very different politicians, if you go back and listen to the debates from 2000, they actually agreed on a huge amount of material, big policy questions. You know, and there were a large number of moderate Democrats and Republicans who agreed with each other across party lines in 2000, and you'd see very little of that today. You know, and I think there's some sort of key moments to in that. One, I guess, precedes our chronology, going back to 1994 with the Republican Revolution then, but then especially the rise of the Tea Party, and then finally Trump. I think the kind of political polarization has been one of the defining features of American history over the past 20 years. And it's not just a political polarization. I think there's a cultural polarization that's going along with it. I think that the ways in which even sort of cultural artifacts become politicized in a way and become you either have to love something or hate something, and it becomes part of a sort of a tribal reaction to almost everything now.
That's right. What you think about Rey in Star Wars has political implications. It's not just
right. And what kind of beer you drink, and you know, all these kinds of things. I mean, that you would think shouldn't be political, but have become so. And I think that's really, you know, looking back on this past 1 year, I think I'm not quite sure where we're headed, because it seems like it's only intensifying. But that is, I think, a profoundly different world than what happened 20 years ago.
Yeah, although let me, I think you're right, but I think if we take a longer view, maybe, you know, political polarization was pretty bad in your period in the 1840s and 1860s.
Yeah, that didn't work out so well.
Certainly in my period in the 1790s. So maybe there was this kind of imagined consensus, which was never all that consensual, really, kind of between, I don't know, the 50s and the 90s or the 60s and the 90s. We've always had political polarization, but technology has exacerbated it.
I think the ability to sort of narrow the fact that the media has become polarized in the way that the politics has become polarized. In fact, I think you're right, does harken back to this earlier era where there were Democratic newspapers and Republican newspapers, or Democratic newspapers and Whig newspapers, much the same way you now have left-leaning media outlets and conservative media outlets. But this seems different in some ways. I don't think, you know, as polarized as things were in you know, the 1850s, that obviously culminated in you know, the greatest crisis the country faced. The degree of polarization now, the way in which it divides everything in society, the ways in which things have a political valence attached to them.
This is one, David, where maybe this is a case where we need our successors in the future will have a better perspective than we do, because I think when you're in the midst of this kind of polarization, it does seem like the worst thing ever, or the most extreme.
To be sure.
And maybe it is,
maybe it isn't. Yes. So after the Second Civil War, they'll tell us that we were in the midst of
because cultural institutions, you know this better than me, but cultural institutions in the United States split in the 1840s and 50s, so you ended up with Southern Methodists and Northern Methodists and things like this. There was pretty bad polarization on cultural terms in the past as well.
Oh, 100%, right. I think that's a good comparison. The other things I would have on my list, I think one of the defining features, and I think this will hopefully show up in the future textbook, is the revolution in gay rights and gender over the past 20 years. I mean, thinking back on it, in 2000, there were still states that had sodomy laws on the books. And now we've ended at a point in which both political parties support gay marriage to slightly different degrees, in which gay civil rights are recognized for the most part across the United States, although there's clearly stories every day in the news of places where they're not.
But those are stories in the news because those stories outrage us, as opposed to
And they're in the news in the before. Oh, to be sure, and they're in the news in the media outlets that we choose to frequent. But I think this has been a really profound change in society, the ways in which we've had both the legalization of gay marriage with Obergefell versus Hodges in 2015. Earlier than that, we had Lawrence versus Texas, which threw out the sodomy laws that were still on the books in a handful of states. And the way and especially among younger people, the culture of sexuality and gender is in a very different place than comparably aged people 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think that's the really big change, in my opinion. And what strikes me is how rapidly it happened. I mean, and I don't want to, Stonewall was over 50 years ago. I don't want to, downplay the significance of the gay rights movement in any way, but the change when it came, really around 2008, 2009, 2010 was so quick. The pressure was building for a long, long time, but the social change, and I think it was largely driven by young people who really couldn't understand why old people cared about this stuff.
Yeah. But it's also worth pointing out in sort of narrating that there was a huge backlash to this while it was going on, right? When I think it was Massachusetts became the first state to legalize gay marriage, there were a number of states that passed either laws or state or amendments to state constitutions to prohibit gay marriage in 2004, 2005, and for a few years after that. I think there was a backlash to this revolution, but I think you're right. It did happen. It seemed to happen very quickly. And that's really remarkable.
Yeah, I would agree. What do you think about how will civil rights in other areas be judged from this period?
Oh, well, it's always hard to, see the prejudices of our own society as clearly because they seem irrational in retrospect. I think we're making headway in terms of dealing with discrimination against the people who have mental illnesses of various kinds. I think we're still working through that. People who are differently abled. I think we are working through ways in which making society more accessible. I think we're still even, long after the American with Disabilities Act, I think we're still processing how to create those in a kind of an accessible society. Those would be the big ones I would think of.
What about race? Because, we've seen... On one hand, of course, we had the Obama presidency.
Yes.
And real progress in certain areas, it would seem, and the increasing diversity of the country demographically. On the other, we've seen this persistence and indeed possible increase of state violence against non-white people, especially African Americans, and Trumpism.
To be sure, extent,
not to a real extent, is a white supremacist movement, and so it seems to me it's been a mixed bag.
I think you're right. I think the tossing out of the Voting Rights Act, for instance, I think is sort of symbolic of the fact that we've taken a step back in many ways from the kind of progress that was made during the 1960s. And I think, you know, one of the ways to sort of make sense of events over the past 20 years is to put it in the context of you know, a much longer civil rights struggle that started, you know, well before Brown versus Board of Education and is going to continue, you know, for many years to come. I think this, you know, the struggle to create a race-blind society is a profoundly challenging one, and it create conditions for a multicultural and diverse society that recognizes the values of immigration and recognize the values that cultural diversity brings to society. I think we still have a ways to go in that respect, especially in the Trump era. So how you'd fit all that into a chapter? I mean, that's the tricky thing about, you know, textbooks is they by nature they have to exclude a whole bunch of stuff, and figuring out what's the four or five notes you get to hit. And this, I guess, is the same thing when you come to give lectures for undergraduates, or when you're teaching high school students, which I did for a while. You have to leave out more than you include, and you have to make difficult choices.
Let me ask you this along those lines. So, will the textbook or the lecture 50 years from now give greater attention? Who's more important historically, Barack Obama or Donald Trump?
Oh, geez. I guess that depends on what happens next week.
One of them is a harbinger of the future, and the
future. Other... Yes, yeah. The question is, what does the future look like? And I think a part of that depends on, whether Trump gets reelected and what that looks like. I guess the two way. There's lots of ways to read this, I guess, but I'm hoping that. And this, obviously, my own political views here are transparent. The way Trump gets read in the future might be as a last gasp, a rear guard action by a minority of Americans who are committed to a reactionary kind of politics. I think that's probably overly simplistic as a model. So I'm hoping that Obama is the more historically significant figure. But Trump is making profound changes to the ways in which American politics works. Is the name of this chapter the age of Obama, or is it the age of Trump?
Of course, two things can be true. So the first two decades of the century could be the age of Obama. And then the next decade is the age of Trump, because it's
Trump
against Obama, yeah. And Obamaism.
You see, I'm not even sure I know what Obamaism is. I know what Trumpism is. And I think Obama's profoundly important in terms of his symbolic value about what he means, that an African American is holding the highest office in the land, that had, you know, a country that had been built on racial slavery, and a country that had practiced segregation for another most of another century after emancipation. You know, I think that's symbolically enormously important. How important he ends up being historically, it's hard. I'm still not quite sure I know yet.
Well, I would say, first of all, I think we're forgetting how significant his intervention at the very start of his presidency was in response to the financial crisis of 2008-09.
Oh, to be sure.
And so there's that. Secondly, there was the Affordable Care Act. Thirdly, the Iran deal. Now, I realize a lot of this stuff is being dismantled, or at least the intention is to dismantle it by Trump. But you have the Iran deal plus the Paris Climate Accord. I think all those were quite really important achievements in a period of quite intense political partisanship, as you noted. And I think all of those were pretty significant, as well as the drawdown in Iraq and so on. So I think those. I think there's a pretty coherent package there.
To be sure. But if had Hillary Clinton won the last election and built on those things, I think they would be much – they'll end up being much more significant in this future textbook than they might be now, where they are being systematically dismantled.
Right. But also – but of course – we don't know who the next president is, and
yes.
when that person will be taking up. You know, so if Bernie Sanders is elected president next November, then suddenly Obamaism or Obama might have prepared the way for Sanders. You know, who knows how this plays out? This is the one thing I would say is, and we're in the realm of counterfactual, and I might have said this on the podcast before, and you know. I don't want to read too much. I don't want listeners to read too much into this. If Mitt Romney had won in 2012, and we were in the second Mitt Romney term right now, we'd be in better shape. So, because Trump and Trumpism was very much a response to Obama and Obamaism, and a response on the part particularly of alienated whites of varying degrees of education and wealth who felt alienated by what they felt Obama stood for and the direction the country was going towards. If Romney had won in 2012, our country and our politics might look very different. And believe me, I was dead set against Romney in 2012. But if we were in the second Romney term, we'd be better off than in the first Trump term, it seems to me.
That seems like a reasonable conclusion to draw. Romney seems. Yeah, I think that's probably.
That trying to predict this stuff is very, very hard.
Very hard. And I guess the final thing I'd put in this chapter, because I'd like to make sure that we're not just doing politics in the chapter. All this is also deeply tied into politics. I think the growing inequality in the United States over the past two decades is really a big part of the story of what's happened in since the millennium. In 2000, the United States was a pretty unequal place. The gap between the top 1% and everybody else was enormously profound. But I think what's happened since 2000 has only exacerbated those disparities. And these are disparities that have been enhanced by federal policy. We can think about the Bush-era tax cuts and then the Trump-era tax cuts, and by the recession, which, the United States has recovered on a sort of macro level from the recession, but it's a recovery that has overwhelmingly benefited those people who were financially well off before the recession and has not benefited to the same extent those people who were already struggling, that is to say most Americans, before the recession. And I think so narrating that story about how the past 20 years has caused these profound inequalities and the ways in which it's going to then shape future politics, I think is going to be a big part of the story. And the generational element of that, too, I think is quite important. I mean, one of the things that's happening over the past 20 years is that the young people who are just coming of age now are one of the probably the first generation of Americans, or maybe the second generation of Americans, who are entering a world in which they are likely to have a lower quality of life than their parents did.
Yeah, we see this in terms of life expectancy is going down, and all kinds of social measures.
Yeah, home ownership, employment, all these kinds of things. So, you know, what the end result of this inequality is going to be, I don't know. But I think that's a big part of the story, and will be, I think, a big part of the story to come in the next few years.
Right, but again, it remains to be seen whether this is a period like the 1890s, or whether this is the beginning of a long-term trend which will you know, carry on for the foreseeable future. And again, it's impossible for us to know that.
Yeah. All right.
Let's end on a good note, though, or at least a good note from my perspective as a Boston okay. man and a New Englander, because, of course, in 2000, in the first decade, two decades of this century, we have seen the New England Patriots dynasty, which seems to be coming to an end.
Yes.
Played six Super Bowls and, well, played in nine Super Bowls and won six of them. We have seen the Boston Red Sox in 2000 were a benighted, cursed franchise, and they are, well, they're cursed in different ways now because they became what they hated, but won three World Series. It's possibly been the best time in history to be a New England sports fan, and because New England really should be America, these were.
the Red Sox are always.
David is a Gothamite.
You know, the Red Sox tend to be very good in the first two decades of any century.
Yeah, so you can look forward to 8 years of success starting this year.
Exactly. We will. Yes. If that's the bright spot, we'll go with that. Time for last drops. What you got?
Right. I mean, this kind of continues with the piece. I want to. And we've talked about the New York Times' 1619 project before, which is a project the Times launched last summer in August. Really taking 1619 as a point of departure for marking the arrival of the first enslaved people in English North America at that point. There had been enslaved people before. Anyway, it's an important date, and the Times used this to launch a project, which was very interesting, taking a kind of historical look at the impact of slavery and race on on the United States and its antecedents over four centuries. It's a very interesting and innovative project in all kinds of ways, and it's won all kinds of accolades and praise from historians. Not everybody, however, and right before, right around Christmas, in fact, a letter appeared. I think it was published first on December 20th, but it actually appeared in print on the December 29th issue of the New York Times Magazine, and it was by five historians, all senior. Let me make sure I get their names right. Victoria Bynum from Texas State University is an emeritus professor. James McPherson, who's an emeritus professor from Princeton in your field, David. James Oakes, who's a distinguished professor of slavery in the United States and the history of slavery. Sean Wilentz from Princeton, and Gordon Wood, who's a professor emeritus from Brown and a very important figure in the history of the American Revolution. And these five historians wrote a letter critiquing the 1619 project. And they basically, on one hand, they were taking issue with particular interpretations, and other, they were critiquing the whole concept because they felt that it was, the intention is that this project should go out to schools and influence the way that the history of slavery in the United States is taught. And they felt that it gave emphasis to the wrong thing. So they wrote this letter to that effect in December around Christmas, and it was published in the New York Times. And the Times presented an extensive editor's response, which is a kind of point-by-point answer to it. I would commend this exchange to anybody who hasn't read it, and I think, as we think about textbooks in classrooms, I think it really would work. It would really work well in a tutorial or seminar or discussion format for undergraduates, because it really lays out some of the main historiographical issues in quite an engaging way. I mean, a lot of people are very upset about this letter, but I think the letter and the response read very well together, and I would commend that to people. Did you read the exchange, David?
I did read. Yeah, I've been following this whole debate pretty closely, and part of me, I think, and there's been some coverage of this, part of the debate is about the specifics of what's in the 1619 project and the history of the history that's portrayed there. And some of it also, I think, is about power and academia and different kinds of territorial fights about who gets to say what the narrative is. And what have
yes,
you.
Yes, in the letter, the distinguished professors in part said, well, we weren't consulted about this.
Yes, exactly. Which I think sort of speaks to that the sense of gatekeeping and who controls history and who has a say in what the narrative is.
One thing I would say before I hand things over to you that worries me a little, because I think the 1619 project has been good. I think this letter is interesting. You're right, it's partially about gatekeeping, but I think the historiographical implications are more important. However, what worries me is, of course, 1620, November of this year, around the election, the end of this year marks the arrival, the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the Pilgrims in Plymouth Colony, in the establishment of Plymouth Colony in Massachusetts. And my fear is, and I think that these historic anniversary should be marked. I think they're great opportunities for us. But my fear is that there'll be a 1620 project, and as a kind of counter to the 1619 project, which may well become a debate about white supremacy or a celebration of white supremacy. And I'm actually quite trepidatious about that. And in
1620, a celebration of white supremacy and the United States as a Christian country,
yes,
probably
that's
as
right,
well.
That's
yeah.
Right. So here we were, fleeing persecution, establishing, a Christian country, the city on a hill, and all that kind of nonsense. And so I'm very worried about that. And of course, in 2021, we'll have the celebration of the 400th anniversary of Thanksgiving, the alleged first Thanksgiving.
That's Thanksgiving, yes. Course,
but anyway. Anyway,
just sort of on a follow-up to that, I was at the AHA, the American Historical Association meeting, just a couple weeks ago, in New York City. And there, in addition to writing this letter, several of the historians you mentioned did these very extensive interviews about the 1619 Project with a World Socialist website,
which
I'd never heard of before. And there were some folks from this World Socialist website who were handing out flyers at the AHA critiquing the 1619 Project, which I thought was a bit odd. But also at the AHA, Nicole Hannah Jones, who was the person in the New York Times who spearheaded this project and wrote a large section of it, was also there at the AHA. And so there was this very interesting place where some of these historians who were very critical of the project were there, this website. And it seems very odd to have these sort of what I think of as being very sort of moderate mainstream historians being interviewed by a socialist website. That didn't make
yes,
any sense.
Yes, if you told me that we were going to have a debate, a public debate in 2020 about what Gordon Wood had to say to the World Socialist website, I would not.
About the New York Times. Yeah, that seems.
Yes.
that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But so it was a very odd moment to sort of having the sort of juxtaposition of all of these things. My last drop is also New York Times related, my hometown paper. There was a really great story over the weekend about, and this connects, I guess, to the episode we just did, about textbooks and about the ways in which textbooks in different states portray different versions of American history. And the interesting thing about this story is that they're pointing out the ways in which California and Texas use the exact same textbook, except it's not the exact same textbook. It looks on the outside like it's the same textbook, has the same author listed, has the same publisher, has many of the same illustrations. But when you actually get into the interior of the textbooks, there are actual meaningful changes in the ways in which American history is narrated in these two books. So there, there's ways in which the California textbook has an annotation about the Second Amendment, and the one from Texas does not. And there's bits in which they talk about immigration in different ways. There are ways in which they talk about the Harlem Renaissance in slightly different ways. And this is because, once the textbook is written, they go to these state boards for approval, and the state boards make demands about what the textbook looks like in their state to make it slightly, to meet whatever state standards and political objective those boards have. And there's a long history about how politicized these textbooks are. Lots of James Loewen and other people have written about it, but I think this is a particularly interesting short piece that sort of compares the ways in which the politics of two states shape the kind of textbook students in those states end up with. So take a look at that article for if you're interested in textbooks, and we'll see whether this future. Yeah, great. Right. Well, Frank, until next time.
All
cheers.
Right, I'll speak to you next week, David. Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.